Okay. Last week I finished looking at the first Labour government after the war, which for Labour Party people is the golden age of Labour. And in general, it's probably true, not just because of the government, but it's probably true that in the 1950s was the biggest improvement in people's living standards in the history of Britain. Now, of course, the Labour government were very proud of this. It was not only because of the Labour government, it was mostly because of the economic boom. People suddenly find they had washing machines, they had toilets inside the houses, they could take their, they could, the adults could go to the doctors and not just the children. There was absolute massive changes, as well as, of course, television and so on. And there were also a certain number of social changes, and I mentioned last week the abolition of capital punishment, which was abolished in 1965. This doesn't mean, although life got much better for people, this does not mean there was no poverty. There was still poverty, but poverty was much more a minority question. In the 1930s, it's like, I know, 30, 40% of working class people were poor. Whereas in the 1950s, it was going right down. It was like 10%, you know, something like that. If you want to read a book or see a film about life in the 1950s, 1960s for poor people, I recommend the film or the book, or the book is best, Kez. It's about a young boy in a school in the north of England. You also get to see the schools, the traditional schools of the 60s. Do you like hospital food? You also get to see the traditional schools of the 50s and the 60s. In many ways, life was much more traditional. Even in the 60s, schools were very... The teachers were quite violent with the pupils. Yeah? Hitting and kicking. Even when I was at school, when I was 11 at school, I saw teachers take a boy, throw him to the ground and kick him. This was not common, but it did happen. And nobody... nothing happened, yeah? The police weren't called, the parents didn't complain. This was something which happened, yeah? Very traditional, sort of really quite violent way of dealing with pupils, as well as the more traditional, formalised things like canes and so on. Okay, let's get back to the government. So Churchill, surprisingly then, comes out with another government in 51, but very careful not to... abolish the welfare state established by the previous government. But Churchill is in bad health and he retires in 1955 and he is replaced by Anthony Eden. The Conservative Prime Minister from 1955, yes?
Any plan for today?
Not yet. I'll tell you if I get to one. I'll tell you if I see one. Okay, I'm not good on plans. So the 1955 elections again, and the Tory majority rises to 58 seats. So Churchill wins in 1951 with the Conservative Party, but in 1955 the Conservatives do even better in the elections. So, interesting situation, yeah? People seem to be relatively happy with the Conservative Party in a period when life is getting better. After Anthony Eden, the next Prime Minister will be Harold Macmillan. We will talk about him in a moment. But one of the most famous things about Harold Macmillan is that when he went to the elections, one of the slogans which the Conservative newspapers used was, "You've never had it so good. Vous n'avez jamais vécu aussi bien." Can you imagine today, it's election time, and one of the parties is trying to win an election with the slogan, "Vous n'avez jamais aussi bien vécu." Yeah. It's not guaranteed to win an election today. It was probably true. When he said it, it was probably true. Okay, because the Conservatives win the election in 1955, again, we have a big debate in the Labour Party. You have far more debates in parties when they lose. Because you need to know why and what to do. And the The Daily Mirror, a popular Labour daily newspaper, had the front page, Attlee must go. On doit virer Attlee. Il nous a perdu deux élections de suite, that's the idea. Attlee must go. This is Attlee, who, of course, is the hero of the Labour Party because of the big social reforms of 1945, 1946 and 1948. Even today, if you talk to old Labour people, Clement Attlee is still their hero. He was an ordinary man. He was the first ordinary man to be Prime Minister, and he brought in these big changes. Now, I want to move on to, this is almost a plan. The next section is called foreign policy. That was almost like a plan, wasn't it? Yeah? Okay. The next section is on foreign policy, Great Britain and the world. So throughout the 50s, it's becoming more and more clear that the Cold War is becoming much more established. The Cold War, then, what is this rather strange expression? On entend tout le temps la guerre froide, mais parfois on oublie même ce que c'est. It's the idea that it's a war, but we don't actually fight. We just accumulate weapons and we're ready. And so it was like a war because it was very, very expensive. Billions and billions of dollars on both sides for nuclear weapons. And it developed this particular idea of mutually assured destruction. This is a theory of international relations between America and Russia in particular, and it's that we have, America has enough nuclear weapons to destroy the cities of Russia 100 times, and Russia has enough nuclear weapons to destroy the cities of America 50 times. Isn't this good? We feel very safe. This is the idea, mutually assured destruction. The theory is nobody can start a war because they would be completely destroyed. And of course, what's amusing about it is the acronym MAD. Yeah. So the military experts who invented the expression also had a sense of humour, yeah? And so they called it MAD, mutually assured destruction. So this is the theory which will dominate international relations between the two blocs for a long time, and changes society a lot. First of all, it assures that the wars are, there is no major direct war between America and Russia, and Britain, of course, on America's side. Instead, you have wars in other people's countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, etc., which is no fun if you're Vietnamese or Cambodian. But it means that Europe lived in relative peace and America lived in relative peace. No bombs. Nobody felt any bombs in Europe between 1945, well, since 1945. So this is the Cold War is established. The United States work very hard to get people on their side with the Marshall Plan. Il y a une plaque dans la place de la Concorde. Ici était signé le plan Marshall d'aide à l'Europe. On bilingue. And of course, on the Russian side again, as well, direct influence, domination of Eastern Europe in the old way, partly by force and partly by help. The same thing, so you've got these two big blocks. And Britain has decided to be on the side of America, no problem. But Britain still kind of feels like it's a major power, mostly because of the empire, the colonies, and little by little, this became more problematic. And over the next few years, there will be massive decolonization. This decolonization, of course, begins with 1948 and India, which is a big, big decolonization, but it will continue, and the British elite will learn slowly. And here are two of the moments that they will learn. First of all, the Malayan emergency. And secondly, the Suez crisis. So in the 50s, these are the two episodes which will oblige the British elite, whether they like it or not, to become much more moderate and modest about what Britain can do in the world, because Britain is not rich enough to continue in the New World. So first of all, the Malayan emergency, this is the expression used officially in Britain, the Malayan emergency. C'est quoi l'expression officielle en France pour la guerre d'Algérie? Il y avait un truc, il n'y avait pas le mot guerre en tout cas. Voilà, les événements. Yeah, it's a bit the same thing. The Malayan emergency, and of course the people in Malaya call it the anti-British National Liberation War. Okay, it's all a matter of opinion, it's all a matter of a viewpoint. So since 1948, there was a rebellion against British rule, and a guerrilla movement, guerrilla war, you have the guerrilla war, which is developed so that a small army can fight against a big army if they have the support of the population. That's the idea of a guerrilla war. You have a small army, and you're fighting against a big army, but the people are on your side, so you can get help and you can hide. This is the theory. And this was the situation in 1948, 1949, 1950. And 35,000 British troops were stationed in Malaya. Malaya va fédérer avec d'autres pays pour devenir la Malaisie plus tard. Malaysia plus tard, but for the moment it's Malaya, close to Singapore. The rebellion was defeated. The British had a bigger army, and they defeated the Malay rebels. However, it became very clear, it became slowly clear that the colonial rule in Malaya was no longer possible. They defeated this rebellion, but there was going to be another one sooner or later. And there was a decision to move back. In 1953, the British government wrote plans for independence in Singapore and in Malaya and the other crown places. And in 1957, Malay becomes independent. So this is one example. I'm not going to talk about all the decolonizations, because there are about 80 different countries which become independent within 15, about 80. Autour de 80 colonies britanniques vont retrouver l'indépendance sur 15 ans. Alors, je ne vais pas vous donner la liste parce que. Yeah, so I want to talk about two or three important examples. So, Malay is one of them. One of the things, the most frequent comments about British decolonization is that the British, for a reason which is difficult to understand, successfully dismantled the empire without a major war. Of course, in France, the Algerian war was a big, serious war with a lot of people on both sides. And the British do not have that. They have fighting against the rebellion in Malay. There will also be, I will tell you in a moment, fighting against a rebellion in Kenya. But there won't be a major war. And so some people consider this as a success for the British elite, because they accepted decolonization without a major war. Why did they do that? I don't know. It's difficult to say. But I think that they understood fairly quickly, perhaps with India, that decolonization was inevitable, and so better make the most of it. So you got some rather unusual situations where, in many colonies, when they had the big independence ceremony, the Queen was there, the British Queen was there, saying, oh, you know, we are so happy that you're becoming independent. It's a bit bizarre, you know, because, you know, they could have not colonized them or gave them independence earlier, but that's not how it works. So you've got this new compromise, partly with a new elite within the colonies making compromise. And in this way, Britain kept some of its influence as the Commonwealth invented a new idea, not the empire, but the Commonwealth, you know, which is more democratic, not democratic, but more democratic. And this is the sign of the time. So how did they do this? Well, let's have a look at the second lesson which they learned in the 60s in 1956. This is probably the decisive lesson where Britain learnt, the British elite learnt that it's time to decolonize because we can't do this anymore. We're not strong enough to do it anymore. So what happens is that the Egyptian president, Nasser, was in negotiation with Britain and America, and they were not sure of their attitude. Originally, they promised money, investment, to build a big dam and called Barrage Hydroelectrique, a symbol of Western cooperation with Egypt. And because they were unhappy with the relations between Egypt and the Eastern Bloc, Czechoslovakia in particular, and the Soviet Union, the British and the Americans changed their minds and said, no, we are not investing in this big, important, symbolic and useful project. We're not investing. We refuse. And so you get tension between NASA and between Britain and America. And the result was that the Egyptian president realized, we have something which is very useful to you. The Suez Canal, the Canal de Suez. And when you say it's useful, it's very useful. If you go all the way around Africa, it's a long way in a ship. It is the Suez Canal was central to the British economy. All of the oil will come through the Suez Canal. All the stuff from everything. Because, like I say, when you go round Africa, it really is a long, long way. En fait, c'est même plus grand que ça apparaît sur les cartes. Pour vous dire, parce qu'on réduit l'Afrique quand on fait la planète. So the British are extremely unhappy, and they say, well, what are we going to do? How can we oblige Egypt not to control the Suez Canal? NASA nationalized the Suez Canal. Il a nationalisé le canal de Suez. So it was a private company, the Suez Canal Company, and he nationalized it. So he says, now people can go through the canal if I want, and I will say how much they must pay to go through the canal. Yeah? And this, obviously, the British and the Americans, very, very unhappy, extremely unhappy. And so they're trying to find a solution. Now, of course, they have the biggest army, but they can't just invade Egypt because, you know, the Soviet Union would not be happy, and many, many people would not be happy. Yeah, so they're looking for some intelligence. C'est beaucoup dire. Some crafty way of dealing with the situation. And so what they do ça fait comte de fées, ça fait science fiction. What they do is the British government have a secret meeting in Paris with the French and the Israelis, and they say. They say to the Israelis, listen, you attack the Suez Canal, and then we will denounce you, and we will bring our armies in to separate the Israelis and Egypt in the name of peace. Okay? And then we have the army in the Suez Canal, so we can control the Suez Canal. That sounds good, doesn't it? So it was extremely cynical and dishonest. And, of course, it was supposed to be secret. And, of course, the problem with secrets, it's the same in your family or with your boyfriend or girlfriend or in international relations. The problem with secrets is the secret came out. That's what happened there. In fact, it actually happened, yeah? On October the 29th, 1956, Israeli brigades invaded Egypt. And October 1956... Israel invaded part of Egypt. And England and France said, this is terrible, you must stop immediately. We are coming to keep the peace. And they did this. They announced that they would intervene to enforce a ceasefire. However, there was a problem. And the problem was that America did not have the same opinion. And at this point, the United States writes a letter, a very, very polite letter. I will try to find an extremely polite letter to the Prime Minister in England, Anthony Eden. And says, dear Anthony, we have the money, stop that immediately. He doesn't say that. It's extremely polite. We understand the importance of it. However, given the situation, we would not feel ourselves, it would not feel appropriate to us. But the bottom of it is that at that moment, Britain needed a lot of money from America, a loan, for the economy. And the Americans said in an extremely polite way, if you don't leave Egypt, you won't get the money. And Britain said, yes, sir. And so they very, very rapidly withdrew from Egypt. In December, France and Britain withdrew. So Nasser was victorious, and even today is a kind of hero because of this. And the British were obliged to realise their true situation, the British elite, and their true situation was not a great power anymore. It was the end. It was the end of the British Empire. You can't look at it that way anymore. And after that, more and more the imperial forces were reduced. The number of British soldiers in the different colonies was slowly reduced after this, because this was the moment when they understood the difference. This will lead to other changes, like the decision not to support, the British decide not to support officially white South Africa and its apartheid regime. This is the wind of change speech that somebody will be talking to you about soon. Yeah. That it becomes clear that the British can no longer act as if the empire has not changed. Meanwhile, in the British Parliament, Anthony Eden says, in Parliament, I promise, I did not know that the Israeli troops were going to invade the Suez Canal. I promise I did not know. And a few days later, a newspaper publishes the secret memorandum. And Anthony Eden goes on holiday because he's very ill. He's not ill at all, but this is the solution is that Anthony Eden goes away on holiday, is very ill, and resigns. Donc il ne démissionne pas officiellement parce qu'il a menti dans le Parlement, mais de facto aussi. He suddenly discovers he is very ill. Yeah, okay, and that's what he does. So it's the end of Anthony Eden, and he is replaced by Harold Macmillan. So this very symbolic event of Suez, the Suez crisis, will teach the British elite that they don't have enough money to be a great superpower anymore. Still in international politics, the different governments of the 1950s continue to develop nuclear weapons. The British test an H bomb, la bombe H est testée par les Anglais à cet moment, and they test the H bomb underwater, under sea, and you can still apparently you can still see the hole. The reason for the nuclear weapons for Britain is that the nuclear weapons were the symbol that we are still a great power. Even today, in the United Nations, there are five countries who have a permanent seat on the Security Council, and these are the only five countries who have an official nuclear bomb. So it's, from the point of view of international politics, it's useful to have a nuclear bomb. People take you seriously. I said officially. I think officially it's just Russia, China, France, Britain, and the United States, yeah. You're right. Germany does not have any nuclear weapons. Definitely, I think it's in the German constitution that they don't have any. That's very the Germans are not a nuclear danger. There are several countries, India, Pakistan, Israel, and two or three more who definitely do have a bomb, but not officially, and not many of them. Whereas the British and the French have lots and lots and lots to play with. Okay. Right. Now, the foreign policy of Britain will continue to be dictated by its triple position. Britain has always been special within Europe because Britain had the choice. They have very important links with America, trade and politics with America, trade and politics with Europe, and trade and politics with the Commonwealth, the ex-colonies. Well, at this moment, the colonies, but later the ex-colonies. So Britain always has these three places to play. And this is the reason that Britain has not been madly enthusiastic about the European Union and has not joined the euro currency, etc. It's because it's not so important. Europe is important, but it's not the key element. There's also the Commonwealth and America. In fact, in the 1950s, Europe was number three. The most important commercial relations were with the Commonwealth and the Empire, and secondly, with America. So, for example, at the end of the 1950s, there was a common defence policy, Politique commune de défense, signée par six pays d'Europe, mais pas l'Angleterre. Pas l'Angleterre. It doesn't interest them, yeah. It doesn't really interest them. Europe is not the main priority. I'm making an effort, you can see this. Social change. We're still in these 30 years, 45 to 75, which are defined in French as les trente glorieuses. One of my favourite French historians is Jean Forestier, who wrote a short book called Les Trente Glorieuses. And at the beginning of the book, this is about France, but it's interesting. At the beginning of the book, he describes one village. 10 pages, he describes one village. And then in 10 pages, he describes another village. Aussi en page alternée, j'ai oublié. And when he doesn't name the villages. And when you look at them, you think, oh, well, the first one, yes, the first one is the second one is a French village in the 1970s. And the first one, oh, it must be in Algeria or Morocco or something. And in fact, no, at the end of the introduction, after the 20 pages, he says, of course, all the readers have understood that I am describing the same village in 1945 and in 1975. I must be less intelligent than the other readers because I didn't notice. But a wonderful, wonderful book where he describes how one village changed in 30 years, and it's absolute massive changes. That's for France. Same situation in Britain, a very, very rapid change, very low unemployment, very confident workers and trade unions. If you lose your job, you can find another one on Monday, no problem. Very, very... also, a certain number of classic social phenomena. For example, in 1950, every week... Is it every week? Maybe not. 40 million people, in any case, 40 million people go to watch football games. Perhaps not every week, but regularly. 40 million. 40 million, yeah. It is massively popular. The number is not so important. Football is massively popular. Television. In 1946, you'll have 15,000 televisions in Britain. In 1956, you have 5 million. It's a massive expansion of television. 5 million in 1956. When I was young in 1965, probably half of my class had a television when I was 6 or 7 years old. Probably half of my class had a television. My family, we had a television every winter. We rented a television in the winter. And in the summer, we invented our own games. We were very bored. I prefer PlayStation, I assure you. In the 1950s, the television became much more varied. Initially, the television was just the BBC. The BBC was had the monopoly. And in 1954, independent television, c'est le titre officiel, that is, commercial television, was founded. And a whole number of new things were invented. For example, the television quiz show. You know, today we're very used to the television quiz show, and there are lots of new varieties, you know, along the lines of Question pour un champion, Le maillon faible. These are new variations, but the very first television quiz shows are in the 1950s. And probably the most famous one began in 1961. It's called Double Your Money. Double l'argent. Also, the 1950s, vacuum cleaners, washing machines, electric cookers. In 1964, half the population had washing machines. That's a good sign. 1964, half the population had washing machines. Today, I think it's 92%, something like that. Washing machines are a very important change in people's lives, and particularly for women. Ne faites pas semblant que vous savez comment c'est de faire la lessive sans une machine, je ne crois pas. Okay, it's hard work. It's very hard work. Especially because at this time, remember, most people have 4 or 5 children. So the washing machine is a very important difference. Of course, today we take it for granted, but it's a very important difference. From 1952 to 1964, les dépenses des consommateurs, c'est-à-dire en dehors du logement, sont augmentées de 45%. People's lives are getting much better. And no doubt the most important thing, unemployment was always under 2%. Unemployment was under 2%. I remember my father being told something he didn't like by the manager, and he told him to fuck off, and he found another job on Monday. Don't do this today. The situation has changed. Okay. In the car factories, it was very, very powerful. In the car factories, they were very well organized, and when they went on strike, the strike lasted for 2 hours, and then they won. There's a wonderful story. There's a book called Working for Ford. Working for Ford was written by a man who worked for Ford in the car factories. Okay, stay with us.
Stay with us.
Thank you. Working for Ford, and he explained how one day it was very sunny, and so they went on strike because they wanted to play football. Okay, and the manager arrived and said, "Oh, you're on strike. What do you want? What do you want?" And they said, "Oh, we want lime juice. Nous voulons du jus de citron vert." And he went to try to find it. Yeah. This is what happens when unemployment is very, very low. Yeah. Because, of course, the manager just wanted happy workers, because his boss would be angry if the strike lasted too long. And so this was just an example. Also, in the car factories, when they worked on a machine, they took a piece of chalk and they drew a line on the floor. And if the foreman crosses that line, I'm on strike. Si le contremaître traverse la ligne, je suis en grève. Now, this is the atmosphere. Very difficult to imagine today. Extremely powerful situation of the workers. Social change. Let's have a little look at the situation for immigrants and for immigration after the First World War. There was a lot of repairing to be done. At least a quarter of the buildings in London were damaged. And also, this was the boom. The new factories, the new car factories, still some textile factories, the new chemical factories making plastics. All of this is from, all of this is 1960s design. This is all 1960s design. You know, it's probably more recent, but all these plastics were invented. And they needed more workers. And so the British government worked very hard to get more immigrants. The British government campaigned for immigrants. They sent experts to Jamaica, Trinidad, to the British English-speaking colonies in the West Indies, and the Lisanda Occidentale, the West Indies, les Antilles, pour vous. Said, "Oh, come to England, you'll have a great time, you know, it'll be wonderful. And you will make more money," which was true. And so a very large number of West Indians came to London and quite often worked, the men worked on the buses and the women worked in the hospitals. And even today in the hospitals, there's just a large number of West Indians and in the buses. I don't know why the buses and the hospitals. Why not? Yeah. Yeah? You have a story about this? Yeah. One of the reasons was that the public sector was much less racist. If you went to a private company and you were West Indian, even today it can be a problem, but in the 60s, souvent c'est même presque pas la peine d'y aller. Whereas the big hospitals and the buses, they wanted workers, and they were relatively even-handed. They were relatively fair about this. So you got a lot of West Indians. Now, very often the West Indians had a difficult time when they came to Britain, because in Jamaica, for example, a lot of the people in Jamaica who came to Britain, they didn't know racism, because in Jamaica, everybody was black, and they came to Britain, and they'd learned about Britain in school. Britain is wonderful, it says in my school book. And when they arrived in Britain, sometimes it could be a big shock to discover this racist stuff going on. And remember, at this time, there are no laws against racism. You can put a sign in your window, house for sale, no black people. It's not a legal problem until 1965. Yeah. And it was common. It was not unusual. It was not unusual. And so racism was certainly a big problem. And it continues to be a big problem, but the everyday racism has definitely reduced. When I was 11 or 12 years old at school, we heard racist jokes every day, or every week anyway. It was absolutely, what's the word, everywhere. And I spoke to my nephew, who's 12 or 13. That's not the case today, which is good. But of course, I mean, it's in my school there were no black people, just hundreds of white racists, but no black people. Yeah, so it was just bizarre and. So the West Indians, and a little later from India and Pakistan, a lot of immigrants who came over to England. And today, in Britain, the biggest ethnic minority is Indian. The biggest ethnic minority is Indian. More than a million people. It's difficult to count because in Britain they count people's identity. When you have the census, le recensement tous les 10 ans, they say, okay, please tick your ethnic identity, white, British, Indian, Pakistani, etc. Yeah, and you can choose. Yeah, if you're Indian, well, if your parents were born in India and you were born in England, you can choose. Oh, I'm British, or oh, I'm Indian. It's a choice. It's an identity. Now, this is something, of course, very different from in France. It is illegal to do statistics like that in France, whereas in Britain it is completely accepted, and you can refuse to answer, but nobody refuses to answer, because it's not part of British culture to refuse to answer questions. Ça dérange personne in England. It's just not a question at all. Now, one of the examples of the problems that racism caused in the late 50s is the 1958 riots in Notting Hill. in Notting Hill, groups of young teddy boys, the teddy boys say it's in obedience musicale de l'époque, to rock and roll, yeah, with rather strange clothes, a bit like cowboy clothes, yeah, with the lessie, yeah, and so on. And they, not all of them were racist, but some of them were organised racists, and they went to attack, in particular, the homes of mixed couples. If you had a couple where one was black and one was white, the teddy boys would come and break their windows, and so on. And this is what happened in Notting Hill in 1958. It was also a part where the fascist party was trying to gain support. And in August 1958, nine white men were arrested by the police. And their car was full of weapons and iron bars and so on. The end result was a series of riots of white young men attacking black people in Notting Hill for a few weeks. After a week or two, groups of black young men, West Indians, organized to defend their part of town. This only lasted 2 weeks, but it was symbolic. It was symbolic. It was the first public violence on the streets between white racists and black people. One of the results was that two years later, they organized for the first time the Notting Hill Carnival, which originally was, the aim was to unite white and black people in the same carnival. And that's the origins. In fact, the good thing about the racist riots was that the result was the Notting Hill Carnival, which today is the biggest West Indian event in Europe, and it's very important. Ça fait presque un plan, je suis fier. So, thirdly then, what is going on in culture? Well, there are a number of writers who are influential around this time. C.P. Snow is one of the influential writers, and he wrote a book called The New Man in 1954. And in 1964, he wrote a book called The Corridors of Power, Les Couloirs du Pouvoir. Novels. These are novels. There were also two or three, or four, or five, people who were writing a new kind of theatre. Now, theatre, for quite a long time, was dominated by upper middle class comedy and romantic fantasy. It was amusing, a bit like, you know, the Oscar Wilde plays, very funny, but not challenging. The 1950s saw the new theatre coming along. Now, one of the most important people in the new theatre wrote his plays in French, but originally in English, Samuel Beckett. And Samuel Beckett wrote in 1955, Waiting for Godot. This was a seminal, an extremely influential play. It was a completely new way of looking at theatre. Where does the story happen? We don't know. When does the story happen? We don't know. Who are these people? We don't know. What happens? Some famous critic said, in this play, nothing happens twice. Rien ne se passe deux fois. Okay. Non, pas rien ne se passe deux fois, mais rien ne se passe deux fois. And if you don't know it, I do recommend a very strange sort of abstract situation where two homeless men are waiting for Godot, donc on suppose God, quelque part, hein. And of course he never comes, and that's it. That's the end of the story. It was exciting. So, and he continued along the same game, the same vein in 1958 with Endgame, and 1962 Happy Days, ou les beaux jours en français. So Samuel Beckett was really destroying the old theatre and coming up with this completely new idea of what you can do in theatre. Some other playwrights at the same time, Harold Pinter. Very influential, Harold Pinter, P-I-N-T-E-R. He wrote in 1958, The Birthday Party. And in 1960, The Caretaker, Le Gardien d'Immeuble. So you have a group of playwrights. Well, let's just give them the second names, actually. These are the British playwrights who were influential in the 50s. John Osborne wrote in 1955 a play called Look Back in Anger. And Brenda Behan wrote in 1958 Borstal Boy. Borstal, c'est les prisons pour jeunes personnes. Enfin, pas tout à fait des prisons, mais c'était pas loin. C'était des endroits pour punir les jeunes personnes, les jeunes criminels. Borstal Boy. And then, finally, we have some novelists like Alan Sillitoe. These are the 1950s novelists. Alan Sillitoe wrote Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. Saturday night and Sunday morning, samedi soir et dimanche matin. So, some of this literature is about destroying the traditional theatre, and some of it is about writing about social reality, which is a kind of new idea at the time. Okay, so this takes us up to 1958 and a new. And we're going to go back to politics. So, still in conservative governments right through to 1964. From 1951 to 1964, we have a continuous conservative government. And Harold Macmillan is the Prime Minister for most of this period. Who is Harold Macmillan? Well, he was half American. He was wounded in the First World War, and he worked in a publishing house. Macmillan, vous avez entendu parler de la maison d'édition, et c'est la même famille. He became a minister during the Second World War and Minister of Housing in 1951, when he worked very hard to build more council houses, became Chancellor of the Exchequer, and won the election in 1959. He became too ill in 1963 and resigned from the prime ministership. But then he lived to be quite old. Later on in his life, after his retirement, he was very, very critical of the Thatcher government. Because Macmillan was one of these one-nation Tories who thought it was possible to be conservative but also defend the welfare state and avoid social conflict. He is also the man who gave this very famous speech, which we're going to hear about in a week or two, the Wind of Change speech, when he recognises that the independence of Africa is inevitable. 1960. He also introduces another reform in 1958, rather a surprising reform, really, and he introduces a reform to the House of Lords. Now, I'm sure you've forgotten everything about the House of Lords. You know that just like in France, you have the Assemblée Nationale and the Sénat. In Britain, we have the House of Commons and the House of Lords. But in some ways it's very different because the House of Lords originally is not really a very democratic conception. It is a house full of aristocrats. Why are, let's say, in 1955, yeah? So before 1958, all of the people who sit in the House of Lords, who decide on laws and amend laws, etc., they are all there because their father was a lord. It's a hereditary principle, so the opposite of a democratic principle. However, there had been one reform in 1911. In 1912, the government had changed the law and reduced the power of the House of Lords. They had said that the House of Commons is the most important one, and therefore, for example, if you pass a law three times in the House of Commons, you don't need the House of Lords to approve it anymore. So he reduced the power. But in 1958, we had a bigger reform. And Macmillan decided that, as well as the aristocrats, you would have more lords who were created by the Prime Minister. In fact, created by the Queen on the advice of the Prime Minister. These are what we call life peers. The traditional lords, are called hereditary peers. Why are you a lord? Because my father was a lord. Okay, fine. The life peers are nominated by the Queen on the recommendation of the government. So after 1958, in the House of Lords, you have a mix. Some hereditary, the bishops as well, who are not hereditary, of course, from the bishops of the Church of England, and the life peers, who are nominated by the government, in fact. Now, life peers is much more democratic. They are not elected, but they are chosen by an elected government. So it's more democratic. It's not a hereditary principle. And so after 1958, the House of Lords was half and half, really. Half the hereditary principle and half a sort of meritocratic, semi-democratic principle. C'est un petit peu comme si le Sénat, au lieu de les lire, vous le remplissez avec tous les gens qui ont reçu la Légion d'honneur. Parce que c'est le gouvernement qui décide qui a la Légion d'honneur. So, like I say, it's more democratic than the hereditary principle, but it's not elected. This is a difficult question because how much democracy is too much democracy? It's hard to say. Yes? Yes, that's right. They do not transmit to their sons.
Exactly. And if the government changes,
they're still peers. They're still peers, yes. Like the Supreme Court judges in the United States, absolutely. They are nominated for life, but only for life. They cannot pass their title onto their sons and daughters while they're sons.
They can resign.
Say again?
They can resign.
Oh, they can resign, yes. It's a good, people don't resign. It's a good job. You know? But yes, they can. Now, this is a difficult question about democracy because, as you know, different countries have different ideas about democracy. In France, we think, of course the Sénat, the Senate, is elected. Of course, that's democratic. Whereas in America, they say, look at the chief of police of Paris. He should be elected. In America, the head of the police force in each county is elected. And so the Americans might look at France. It's not a democratic country. They don't elect the police, yes? So there are a lot of different forms of democracy, a lot of different opinions. And so that was a big change in 1958 when Harold Macmillan said, we're going to have two kinds of lords. And, je vous vends la mèche, in 1999, the hereditary peers lose their right to vote in the House of Lords. And so after 1999, the House of Lords is entirely, or almost entirely, controlled by life peers who are nominated by different governments. So the aristocratic principle no longer exists in the British Parliament. Yeah, it's disappeared. It's surprising. A lot of people didn't notice because we keep the same name, the House of Lords. And when you see, when Monsieur Lambda sees House of Lords, they think, oh, aristocrats. This is not the case in Britain anymore. If you vote in the House of Lords, it's because you're a life peer. That is, that you were named because you were a famous historian or a top civil servant or sometimes a rock singer. Yeah? Paul McCartney, etc. Yeah? Now, you have to be careful what kind of rock music you sing if you want to end up in the House of Lords. If you were a trade union leader for many years, then you become a life peer. That's very typical. Yeah. So a big change happened in 1999. But yeah, so this rather surprising reform. Now, there are a few things you can say about this. First of all, you can see that the British reform things very slowly. The House of Lords. We had a reform in 1912. Oh, let's have another one. 1958. Let's have a third one. 1999. Ils sont pas pressés, hein? It's a very slow reform. But nevertheless, things do change. Yes.
Then Macmillan named people from the left side, but only the right.
That's an interesting question. So does a Conservative government only name Conservatives? And does a Labour government only name Labour? Well, they have to be careful because the naming is very public. And so, yes, in general, they name more people who are on their own side. But they always try very hard to name some people who are on the other side and a lot of people who are not really political. Because they are worried, you see, if they only name big Conservatives, then that could be a negative point for public opinion for the next election. So they are careful. And very often, so it's not unusual to have a trade union leader made into a lord by a Conservative government. Yeah. It can happen, yeah. So yes, of course, in general, they prefer people who are close to them, but it's not systematic. They try to look objective. Yeah. Just in the same way that, in theory, a Conservative president in France does not give the Légion d'honneur only to people of his own political opinions. Probably more to people of his own political opinions, but it's not. So it's a good question, that. So those are the big changes for Macmillan. Some of them surprising. I don't know why in 1958 the life peers arrived, but they did. Let's have a look at number two, the Profumo scandal. The Profumo scandal was a scandal. And it caused a lot of problems because Profumo was the Secretary of State for War, the Ministre de la Défense. Okay? He was having a relationship with a young woman who was also having a relationship with a member of the Russian KGB. On dirait un film, hein? This became public. The Minister of Defense, en fait, à l'époque, c'est le secrétaire d'État pour la guerre encore, Secretary of State for War. He was questioned in the House of Commons, and he said, "Is it true that you have a relationship with Christine Keeler?" And he said, "No." No, ça fait du Bill Clinton, yeah. He said no. Slowly the newspapers revealed, one, that he had a relationship with this girl, and two, she was also sleeping with an attaché at the Soviet embassy. Okay, so, yeah. This caused a massive scandal. The man who introduced the Minister of War to Christine Keeler was arrested for proxenetisme, for living on immoral earnings, and he committed suicide. So, an even better scandal. So, a wonderful scandal. And the result was that Macmillan, the Prime Minister, was obliged to resign. He claimed he was resigning because of bad health, but in fact they worked hard on that. So the Conservative Party had to choose a new Prime Minister, a new leader of the Conservative Party would be Prime Minister. One of the possibilities was Lord Butler, who was very important for the education in the 1945 Education Act. But he was a one nation Tory, and the Conservative Party decided not to elect him, and they chose Alec Douglas-Home as the new Prime Minister. Well, as the new leader of the Conservative Party and therefore Prime Minister. So who was this Alec Douglas-Home? Well, he didn't last very long. He was Prime Minister for 1 year, and then there was a general election which the Conservatives lost. Home. Oh, oui, c'est mal écrit. It's a home. Yeah. Okay, so he didn't seem to do anything, you know, particularly stunning. Let's have a look at the section about being an immigrant, because the... J'avais oublié une chose. Dans la réforme de la Chambre des Lords de 58, pour la première fois, il y a des femmes qui entre dans la Chambre des Lords, parce qu'on peut nommer n'importe quelle personne, le first one. So being an immigrant, well, there are two important laws about immigration in this period. And they represent the two symbolic periods. First of all, the 1948 Act, which says any person from the Commonwealth, so from all the British colonies, can come to the United Kingdom and work and bring their families. So the 1948 Act was very liberal because Britain needed workers. And Britain needed a lot of workers. And 1962 is the beginning of the end because the 1962 Commonwealth Immigrant Acts says you can only come, if you come from the Commonwealth, you can only come if you have a voucher. That is to say, you can come if you have a job, which is the kind of job that there is a shortage of in Britain. Yes, so for example, if you are a building worker and we need building workers, then it's okay. But it is a system of quotas to limit immigration. This is the first, law to limit immigration after 1945. This is carried out hand in hand with a series of laws against racism after 1965. We will come to those a little later on. After 1965, there are some laws against racism. Initially, very, very mild, very, very moderate, very, very weak laws against racism, but later on, more stronger. Okay, the last thing before we move on to the Labour government of 64, the last thing is the situation in Kenya. I want to mention Kenya because there are... what about decolonisation? Good point. Well, where's decolonisation gone? Who has stolen decolonisation? It's a good point. It's disappeared. Decolonisation has disappeared. That's all that far too much. Far too much information here. Yes. I don't know. It disappeared. Well, in fact, Kenya is an example of decolonisation. Through this period, all British colonies in Africa will gain independence. Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Gambia, Uganda, Malawi, Zambia, they will all become independent. And the one where the process will be the most violent is the case of Kenya. I mentioned already that there was no major war, but Kenya is certainly the most violent situation. A few days ago, I put this on my blog, a few days ago there was a decision in a court in London which said that people who had been tortured by the British in Kenya could go to court and demand damages for torture. As you know, for reasons which I don't understand, sometimes these things come to justice 50 years later. Very extremely slow. But there's been a recent case, and I'm pretty sure that the government has officially apologised, which is nice. But you know, it's something. So here is a story from 1959 in Kenya, in March 1959, and the prisoners the political prisoners in Kenya were ordered to work in a prison camp, and they refused to work because they said, "We are political prisoners, we refuse to work." And this is what one of them tells the story. "There were 200 guards. 170 stood around us with machine guns. 30 guards were inside the trench with us. The white man in charge blew his whistle and the guards started beating us. They beat us from 8 o'clock until 11:30. They were beating us like dogs. I was covered by other bodies, just my arms and legs were exposed. I was very lucky to survive. Afterwards, 60 men were seriously injured and 11 were dead. The official story that came back to England was that the men died because they had drunk bad water, which was contaminated. But some newspaper journalists found out the truth, and this was in all the newspapers, and it was an enormous scandal. There was a political uproar, and within a few weeks, the British government closed the prison camps and liberated all the people in it. That's in 1959. The fights of the movement for the independence of Kenya continued. The fighters were known in England. Ce n'était pas le nom, c'était le surnom. But the surnom was the Mau Mau. They were fighting against the British. At the end, 1,000, during the period of 1959, over the 2 years, 1,000 were hanged, and 150,000 died. Yeah, 150,000 Africans died in the fight for independence. But in 1961, they were successful and they gained independence. That was the most violent. 150,000 dead is quite a violent thing. And quite a lot of that was also disease and starvation. But that was the hardest. Part of decolonization in British Africa. This is just a history of Kenya, but I'm not going to read it to you because it's too long. But certainly, as a general rule, the story is pretty black and disgusting, as colonialism is in general. So there was nothing special about British colonialism. It was like most colonialisms, which is not really very nice. But the relatively successful transfer from empire to Commonwealth was something rather specific. The 1960s, of course, is famous for being the years of liberation and hippies and so on and so forth, especially the end. Let's have a look a little bit at some of those elements in Britain. First of all, at the beginning of the 1960s, there was a massive movement against nuclear weapons. This began in 1957. There was a debate inside the Labour Party about nuclear weapons, a very passionate debate, because on the one hand, inside the Labour Party, on the one hand, you said there were people who said, Britain is a great country, we need nuclear weapons to continue being a great country, to be influential in the world. If we abandon nuclear weapons, then America and Russia will rule the world. But we are more intelligent and humanitarian, so we need nuclear weapons to have influence in the world. And this is not my opinion, this is the opinion, one opinion. And the other opinion inside the Socialist Party, inside the Labour Party, is, well, no, we are socialists. Nuclear weapons can kill millions of people, and they don't distinguish, they don't kill only the rich and not the poor. They don't kill only the bad and not the good. They are completely indiscriminate. And so a socialist party can never support nuclear weapons because they cannot be socialist. Okay, guns, if you have a gun, you can choose. Yeah, you can shoot the oppressor or the oppressed. You can shoot the rich or the poor. You can choose with a gun. With a nuclear weapon, you don't choose at all. And therefore, some people inside the Labour Party said, the Labour Party must be against all nuclear weapons. We must be for unilateral disarmament. Donc le désarmement unilatéral, c'est-à-dire qu'on abandonne les armes nucléaires, même si les autres le font. Yeah? Also, many people said that nuclear weapons should be abandoned because they are immoral. So there are a series of arguments. And a mass movement developed between 1959 and 1963, for 4 years, there was a mass movement against nuclear weapons, which was supported by a section of the Labour Party, but which was not directly linked to political parties. It was an alliance of socialists, pacifists, Christians, and just people who didn't want to have nuclear weapons exploding in the world. It was very big. The first meeting in 1958 got 5,000 people. Many important figures signed the appeal. Benjamin Britten, je cite ceux que vous risquez de connaître, Benjamin Britten, the composer, Barbara Hepworth, the sculptor, Henry Moore, another sculptor, that's two sculptors, Michael Tippett, the cartoonist, Fenner Brockway, Lord Fenner Brockway, A.J.P. Taylor, the historian. They established the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And they invented, it was a modern campaign, so they needed a badge. This was the beginning of the badge. And they invented a new symbol to represent nuclear disarmament. This was invented in 1959. And the meaning of this symbol is not what everybody has told you. It means nuclear disarmament. C'est du sémaphore. N-D. Nuclear disarmament. And that is the origin of this symbol. Of course, later on, it became linked to hippies and so on. Yeah. It became a mass movement, very big demonstrations, a lot of leaflets, pamphlets, etc. Really very, very big movements. And at one point, about 30% of the population were in favour of unilateral disarmament. Je crois qu'ils ont jamais eu la majorité, hein? Quite a big minority. After 2 years of big demonstrations, there was not much progress, and so some famous members of CND formed a new organisation, the Committee of 100. They were 100 famous people, in fact, and they carried out occupations, des cités, des occupations, etc. And one of the most famous was Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was a great mathematician and philosopher. He joined the Committee of 100, and they would occupy to protest against nuclear weapons. And one day he was sitting in front of the Houses of Parliament, and a policeman arrested him. He was 96. He was 96 years old. And I'm sure the policeman was in trouble with his boss afterwards, because the photograph of Bertrand Russell being arrested was on the front page of every newspaper in the world. And so it was a good political thing. So there's an important campaign. After 1963, however, the campaign declined, and obviously had not succeeded in getting its aims. However, the organisation of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament turned out to be very useful a little later on. The campaign against the Vietnam War and many other campaigns involved the same people. So it taught people how to campaign. The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, in fact, has two big waves of activity. This is the first one, 59 to 63. And 20 years later, from 78 to 82, there is another big wave of activity which radicalizes a lot of people. Okay, so that's a symbol, really, of the strength of single-issue campaigns. Not directly dependent on the political parties. And that's one of the important ones. We arrive in 1964 and we have a new government. Harold Wilson wins the election for the Labour Party. Harold Wilson smoked a pipe. He always used to say, I think I said this at the Labour conference. That was Harold Wilson. I'll try to find a video of him to put on the blog. He's an amusing person. He was on the left of the Labour Party, more or less. In 1951, when Aneurin Bevan resigned in protest against against the reduction of free service in the National Health Service, Harold Wilson resigned with him. And so Wilson becomes the new Prime Minister. 64. Initially, he has a very small majority. He has a majority of 4 seats in Parliament. But 2 years later, he will win another election with a much bigger majority. So what are the most important things which happen in Harold Wilson's premiership between 1964 and 1970? Quite a lot of things happen. I will give you more detail in a moment, but abortion is made legal in 1967. In 1968, homosexual relations between adult men are also made legal. So the two very big, important social reforms, the legalization of abortion and the legalization of homosexual relations. However, what is interesting about these two reforms is that these two reforms were not in the election manifesto. In 1964, when it was election time, when it's election time, every party writes a manifesto to tell the world what we will do if we win. This is a manifesto. And in the Labour Party, they did not say, we will make abortion legal. And they did not say, we will make homosexual relations legal. Because they said, we will probably lose votes if we say this loud. However, once they were in government, they decided that it was the right thing to do. This is an interesting case here. Two very big reforms which were introduced by a government who obviously was not so confident that they had public opinion on their side. This is a very difficult question because public opinion is not independent. If you make something legal, that changes public opinion. For example, in Britain and France, a few years ago, it became legal to have a civil partnership if you were of the same sex, le Pax en français qui est ouvert aux homosexuels. And after the law, public opinion went in favour. After the law, not before the law. This is very typical. That very often, of course, public opinion helps you if you have a law to pass. But also, if you pass a law, it can change public opinion, which is something very difficult to understand or explain in any detail. So back to Wilson. Wilson tried to talk about socialism in a new way. He didn't want to... Remember in 1945 to 1951, the Labour Party was divided between people who said, oh, we need more nationalisation, we need to fight against the capitalists. And those people said, no, we need social reforms, but capitalism is okay. A compromise between the two. And certainly when Harold Wilson came back in, he was not going to bring in more massive reforms. Those are important reforms, abortion and homosexuality, but they're not very expensive reforms like free hospitals they're not massive social reforms. Yeah, you could imagine, because in 1945 the Labour Party said free hospitals, free dentists, free glasses, you could imagine, this is not what happened, that when they are elected in 1964 they could say free buses, free trains. Yeah, make more things as a public service and not to be paid for. They didn't do this. The 1960s was not the same. It was not the same dynamic. And this is what Wilson said about his. I won't give you all the details because somebody's going to talk about this speech. This is Harold Wilson. In all our plans for the future, we are redefining and we are restating our socialism in terms of the scientific revolution. But that revolution cannot become a reality unless we are prepared to make far-reaching changes in economic and social attitudes which permeate our whole system of society. Just a short... That's enough, in fact. Very interesting, because it's a complete transformation. In 1945, Anoira Bevan said, we need free hospitals for everybody, because only the rich have doctors at the moment. And the rich, really, he openly said, I don't like the rich, I want to defend the workers against the rich. And here you have something which when Harold Wilson talks about socialism, it's not about conflict between the rich and poor or conflict between the workers and the bosses. It's about reorganizing society to be in tune with the scientific revolution. Something completely different, really. And the idea is that, one, the boom will last forever. We're not worried about the economy because the boom... You know. And so the only problem is how can we deal with inequality and social problems, etc. And the correct way, in Harold Wilson's opinion, is to make sure that Britain is the most advanced, the most scientific. We need new universities. We need more. We need to have a better situation for scientists so they don't leave Britain to go to America. And if we run the economy well, then life will get better for poor people because of the prosperity. So socialism is not about the rich against the poor, in Harold Wilson's view. And it is an extremely surprising sentence. We are redefining and we are restating our socialism in terms of the scientific revolution. Certainly, if you resurrect Karl Marx, and he sat there and you read that to him, he's going, I don't understand. What is the connection between the scientific revolution? This is something completely different. So a big, big change there, and somebody will be analysing that for a moment. As I said, the other important change was homosexuality and abortion, but also a change in the law about divorce. Divorce became easier in the 1960s. This was very controversial at the time. Today, I think public opinion is probably in favour of divorce being a little easier. But at the time, this was very controversial. Harold Wilson had an advantage in that the leaders of the trade unions wanted to cooperate with Harold Wilson, because they were sure that life would be even worse under the Conservatives. After 13 years of Conservative government, 1951 to 1964, the trade unions were ready to be very cooperative with the Labour government, because they said, oh, even if we're not so madly happy with what they're doing, the Conservatives would be worse for us as trade unionists. So we sometimes refer... Conservative newspapers referred to this period as the period of beer and sandwiches at number 10. This is the idea that when the government, Harold Wilson, had a problem with the trade unions, there's a conflict. Yeah, they want 10%, the government only wants to give 5%. He invited, this is the theory, he invited the union leaders round to his, come round to my house, I've had some beer, have some sandwiches, we're all friends together, let's discuss this problem. This is a symbol, it's a journalist's phrase, it's a symbol of close cooperation between government and trade unions. And in fact, when Margaret Thatcher, much later, when Margaret Thatcher is elected, she will say, there will be no more beer and sandwiches at number 10. He actually says this, yes, no more beer and sandwiches at number 10. Harold Wilson thinks that it is possible to keep the economy going well by more planning. A national plan is adopted, but it's not madly successful. And there is an attempt to change relations between trade unions and bosses in 1969 with a document in place of strife. Quelqu'un va nous l'expliquer en détail bientôt. In place of strife is a government document. À la place du conflit. And this government document says conflict between workers and bosses is not necessary. We can find a new way of solving problems altogether. This is in place of strife. It's very important because it is the first attempt since 1945 to control for government control of strikes and strike action. For example, this document suggests une délai de réflexion imposée, on dit en anglais, a cooling off period. That is to say, if you are a trade union and you want to strike, you must wait 10 days and consult your members, etc., or ask for help from the government or something. But you must have, there is a period of reflection before calling a strike. Now, the difficulty of this is that if you work in a factory and you want to win a strike, the best way is to strike now. If you wait 10 days, the boss has phoned, is it okay if we deliver your thing in 2 minutes? Okay. And he can get supplies from somewhere else. The boss can reduce the damage of the strike if they have 10 days to notice. Yeah. And so from the point of view of the power of organised workers, immediate is the best way to win. So the trade unions did not like this document at all because it's reduced the power of organised workers. In fact, it is a failure from the point of view of the government. The trade unions will not cooperate with it, and it is abandoned. But it's important because it's the first example. There will be 5 or 6 examples of the government intervening to control trade union activity, it will. Je fais pas durer le suspense. It is the governments of Margaret Thatcher who will successfully use the law to make trade unions much weaker. But this is the first attempt to do it, and it is not successful. Okay, what else is happening then in this period, 1964 to 70? Well, one very important reform is in education, where the idea of comprehensive schools is generalised. Does anybody know what is the idea of a comprehensive school in French? Well, it is, in French, it is le collège unique. That is to say, remember I explained to you, I think I explained to you, I don't know who I explained to now. After 1945, there were two different kinds of schools. Grammar schools for the more intellectual and secondary modern schools for everybody else, a divided system. The more intellectual people separated off here, yeah, into the grammar schools, and the less intellectual separated off. So a division at 11 years old, a division, and a system which is generally considered to be elitist. During the 1960s, this system was slowly abolished. C'est long le temps, il faut 15 ans. Chaque région le fait à son rythme. That's very English. When you have a reform in education in France, it happens on Monday morning in every school in France. It's a very centralised system. In Britain, most of the educational decisions were taken in different regions. So this introduction of comprehensive schools, the same school for everybody, took 10 years, 1965 to 1975. Why? Why did they want to do it? Well, the first reason is that because the economy is changing. You have the chemical industries, plastics, the beginnings of the computer industries. Companies are much bigger. You need more accountants. You need more bank employees. You need more sophisticated people. Even shops are becoming supermarkets, and supermarkets are becoming chains of supermarkets. There's more sophisticated work to be done, and they need more education. And so they introduced the idea that, first of all, that university is not only for the top of the elites, and the universities are slowly opened until today. 45% of the population go to university. It's more in France. Secondly, the comprehensive school. So this is slowly introduced. So this is considered to be a modernization. It took a long time because in some regions there was resistance. In some of the more conservative regional governments, they said, no, this is bad. Our children go to the elite school. We don't want them with everybody else, or this chakai, yeah, etc. Yeah. Remember another big difference between the British school system and the French school system. À mon avis, vous n'êtes pas tous au courant. How many children in England do you imagine go to private school? Percentage, approximate. What percentage of young? Yeah? A lot of them. That's not a number. Let's have a number, go on. 60%? 70%? 65? That's big, isn't it? So it's to private schools, that's massive. 7%. Yeah. Only 7%. Much lower than in France. Yeah. Now, first of all, the reason you made the mistake, it's because of Harry Potter and Agatha Christie and the famous five, La Bande des Cinq, etc. Yeah, that British private schools are very famous. Yeah. Secondly, why is it so low? Well, it's a very simple reason why it's so low. In France, if you go to private school, and many people do, you don't have to pay the whole cost. Normally, if you go to private school in France, the government pay the salaries of the teachers. And you pay something. But it's not difficult to go to private school in France for 2,000 euros a year or something around that level. That's perfectly possible. In Britain, if you send your children to private school, you pay everything. The cost of the buildings, the salaries of the teachers, the real cost. So if you want to send your children to private school in Britain, you pay minimum 10,000 euros a year or 20,000 or 30,000. And so, of course, the result is only 7% of people. Yeah, so it's a purely material reason. The second reason, which is very, very important, is that in France, many people, especially Catholics, but also Muslims, send their children to private school because they want some religion at school, either prayers or a religious atmosphere. Whereas, remember, in England, there is religion in all the schools, all the public schools, all the state schools. Yeah. We have religion in every school. And so it's not necessary, if you're a very religious person, it's not necessary to choose a private school. So this is a very, very different situation. Only 7%. Only 7% of young people in Britain go to private schools. Right, okay. So, je ne sais pas pourquoi je dis ça, mais ça me semble tout d'un coup important. So the introduction of the comprehensive school between 1965 and 1975. It was very slow. I was in the middle. I went through the old system. I went to a grammar school, an elitist grammar school, but not a private school, a public grammar school. The other thing about state schools in Britain is that you have Catholic state schools and Protestant state schools. That is, there are many, many Catholic schools in Britain. They are not private. All the money comes from the government, and the children do not pay. But the teachers are hired by the church. There's very bizarre sort of mix things. Yeah. The concept of this separation of church and state is not the same in Britain. Okay. So those are some of the changes that Harold Wilson introduced. He wanted to reform the House of Lords and to abolish the aristocratic principle, but he didn't do it. And so we had to wait until 1999. Yeah, a long wait. And it's 5 to 3, but I think that's enough for today. Do you have any questions? Okay, that's enough for today. Do have a look at the blog. I will put some things on about this period. And you also need to be reading a history book, because I want to read, when we get to test, to the time for the test, I want to read lots of interesting things I didn't know. Okay. Thank you, and good night. Attention, feuille de présence avant que vous partiez, s'il vous plaît. N'oubliez pas de signer la feuille de présence.